as time goes on. At the moment, everything I'm doing so far has come out of this book of draft. Other questions? Okay. It's always good to play with examples. And I'm about to discuss one of my favorite examples. But before we do, I thought I would show you, for those people who want to do something more interesting than just check what we did before, do what we just did before, but take your age minus d squared plus pi squared over 1 minus p. Plus m squared equals 0. So this is a little homework problem. But just work out what are all the equations of motion and everything in that case. And see if everything goes through. Anybody recognize that?
From doubly special relativity.
It is from doubly special relativity. It is a, it is DSR 2.5. What it's worth. Okay. Now, I'm going to continue to talk about time reparameterization invariance. So now we're talking about example two, and we're still going to have the same setup. And now I'm going to have more particles, not just necessarily one particle. So n particles in R to the d. So again, we have xai of s. And we're still going to have reparameterization invariance. So I'm going to be interested in s goes to s prime, which is f to the r to be an invariant of the dynamics. But I'm not going to cheat. What I did before is I really cheated. It was on the board that I just erased. I cheated because I set up the problem by choosing an action which is integral pq dot minus lambda times the Hamiltonian constraint. So I put the thing already in my hand in the form where there was an invariance. And I also, just to make it easy, because I just explained the relationship between the Hamiltonian and Lagrangian point of view when there are constraints, I put the constraint right in the definition of the Lagrangian. So I kind of made it too simple. Not only that, I really cheated because even if there is invariance in this example, under reparameterizations of the time, there's another physical meaningful time coordinate. There's still here x0, and x0 is the clock time of some external observer. So this is not really like general relativity. In fact, it's special relativity. So I want to do something which is more like general relativity, and more like general relativity meaning that there is no preferred background time. So this is not the class where I give a speech about background independence and relationalism and so forth. That class is coming, for those of you who haven't heard it. But the philosophy, the philosophical idea, partly behind general relativity, is that there's nothing fixed and non-dynamical about the geometry of space and time. And in special relativity, there is a fixed and non-dynamical metric. So I want to do something which is a form of dynamics, something like Newtonian dynamics, with is no fixed preferred time, notion of time at all, neither a parameter nor any other one. Time in this example is going to be what Leibniz wanted time to be, which is just an order of succession. So in other words, I'm still going to have, I'm going to be able to use any time order that, or any time parameter I want, just like in general relativity, but it's not going to be any preferred time parameter sitting in the space-time metric, which is fixed and non-dynamic. Okay?
Okay.
So this is an exploration of trying to get at something like general relativity, following the ideas of Leibniz, which we'll be reading and discussing much later on in the class. This particular version of it is due to Julian Barker. Some of us know this example very well. These are a set of dynamical systems which are, if you like, what Mach and Leibniz should have done. Not just a lot of words, but they should have written down a dynamical system that has no preferred notion of time in it, like even in special relativity has the special relativistic clock, which just responds to the space-time metric. Here's the idea. The idea is the conceptual idea, basic idea, is that time should not be something which sits in the background. Time should be something which emerges from the system. And therefore, to realize that, we want a situation, unlike our previous example, we want a situation where wherever time parameter enters, one could have used any other time parameter. So there's no physical meaning for the time parameter. And there's nothing else like x0 sitting there, which is some fixed absolute time parameter. And this is a problem that Julian Barber said himself. He developed several versions of it. The particular version that I'm going to discuss was developed in collaboration with Toby. And a bad guy, I didn't bring the reference with me, so the references to this will be on the webpage. Okay. But everything you need to know about the system will be, I will describe to you. And this is not relativism, so it's just very simple partial mechanics. Now, what do we usually do? We usually write down an action for a system of particles, which is integral ds, and we write the difference between the kinetic energy and the potential energy, and everybody's familiar with that, that's the Lagrangian. And just let me write that out, the definitions. The kinetic energy is the sum over the particles, m of the particles over 2. I you probably used x here where I'm going to q, q dot a, q dot b, just the metric of flat space delta ab, sum over all the particles I, like that. And the potential energy, let's just take interaction between pairs of particles, so the sums over all the pairs of particles are less than j of some function script v of the distance between xi and xj using the standard Euclidean definition for the distance, that is the square root of xai minus xj. The same thing with a down here. It's some arbitrary function of the distances between pairs of particles, if you add that up. So this is classical mechanics. Okay, question. Okay, yes. And everybody knows how to describe the Lagrangian and Hamiltonian of this, so we're not going to go do that. This is not reparameterization variant. And the reason is that the ds sphere, remember the calculation I did before, ds was canceled by a dqbs, But now we have an EQDS squared, so that's not canceled. And so this term is not invariant, and neither is this term, because there's nothing that cancels the transformation of the dS. So neither term is invariant.
Sorry, just one second. Keep going back to x's.
Oh. I wrote a Q there. Thank you. I probably said
no is a B, but the version of B.
Thank you.
X and Q mean the same thing.
X and Q mean the same thing, but thank you. Okay. So ordinary Victorian mechanics is not invariant under arbitrary changes of the time coordinate. The time coordinate is meaningful in Newtonian mechanics. Take S to a function of itself, and the solutions change. They're different solutions. They're physically different. And you can tell because the action does not go to the action under this transformation here. Okay. Now, the question that Barber and Bertoni asked is there a simple way to make an action of those pieces, which is invariant? And some of you in the audience know the answer, and some of you don't know the answer. So, is there somebody who doesn't know the answer but just understood it while I was erasing the blackboard? You already knew it, it doesn't count. Okay. So, one answer is to do the following, is to do integral ds. Let's just think about the kinetic energy term. The kinetic energy term, I want something that transforms like one power looking like ds. So why not take the square root of the kinetic energy? That is invariant under reparameterizations. Okay? Does everybody see that that's invariant? This, again, you have a ds. Down here you have a square root of a ds squared, and they cancel each other. Okay? So, that's great. How do you get forces in the game? Well, if you just do that, you're not better off than you were before. So, these gentlemen suggested multiplying by that. Square root of t times square root of t. And if, just to make things well defined, I'm going to consider the potential energy to be less than zero. So we're dealing with attractive forces, in which case I was not to get totally screwed up, I'll put a minus b there. Now that is in there. Because I already have canceled the 1 over ds here, and this square root of d is just going along for the ride. And so this is the action of Barber and Bertoni. And it's our second example. And it's an instructive example. Let's find the Lagrange equations. So delta s, delta q dot, the q dots are sitting in t. And so what's this is going to be? The minus b stays. The derivative of square root of something is 1 over square root. So I get a minus b over t. B and t will always stay the same. I then take the derivative inside of the 1 half because of the square root. I take the derivative of t I get the usual m times 2 times 1 half. I always get the 2's wrong when I teach this example, so we'll see.
Is there not a 2 in the action?
Yeah, there are not. Yes, is that the 2? You work with this form here recently, then. Well, there, look, the kinetic energy is m over 2 v squared.
I think there's a 2 factor to the action.
Where?
Just in multiplying it.
Not that one. Here.
No, that's Barbara Bertillion.
Here.
Yes, no.
Bob and Jeremy, the variation.
Yes, I won't do anything. Let's do it straight and then find the...
So the O2 is just the last O2 you've got there in the equation motion should be there.
So there's a 1 half.
That's right.
There's another 1 half, and there's a 2, so there's a 1 half. Okay, and there is a Q dot, this is a Q dot A, and this is a Q dot B, there's a delta B here, and I think that's the honest answer. So the Euler de Grand equations say, d by dt of all of this is equal to, now I take the derivative by q of this. The same thing happens, only now I get a square root of t over minus v. There's a minus sign that comes out, and there is a sum over j not equal to I, and there is a u dot. And the missing 2 is indeed there. If you just stare at it, I promise it's there. If it's not there, then there's a 2 stuck in here. Or another way to say this is just V prime. Okay? So these are the Euler-Lagrange equations. And they're much more complicated than the Euler-Lagrange equations of Newtonian dynamics. Because sitting inside of here is the ratio of the potential, the total potential energy to the total kinetic energy. And that can change. And remember, this is a system. Imagine, think of the solar system with all the planets and asteroids and moons and satellites and so forth whizzing around. The total potential energy is changing in time. The total kinetic energy is changing in time as things whiz around, things come closer to other things, go away from other things. Okay? And in order to get to the acceleration, what this is supposed to be, I have here to take a derivative of the square root of the ratio of the total potential by the total kinetic energy. So it's a horribly complicated, non-linear, non-local system, something with the orbits, what's happening over at Jupiter, and the satellites of Jupiter are influencing the orbit of the moon. Not directly by the gravitational force, but by changes in this. And here again, we have a ratio of the total kinetic over the total potential energy. So this is a number which, this is a function which is moving around. It's influenced by everything going on in the whole system. Okay, so this appears to be a horribly, and our time parameter starting with S, a horribly non-local, self-interacting mess. Okay? But, there is a but. And the but is that we're not looking at invariant quantities. Because we have the freedom to choose any time parameter that we want. And under the freedom to change the time parameter, the kinetic energy in particular goes to a new kinetic energy which is the kinetic energy over F prime of F squared. So that's sort of interesting. By choosing the time coordinate, I can make the kinetic energy anything I like, because the function f is a free function. It only has the amount of time, so there are some global constraints from that. So I can make the kinetic energy anything I like. The total, not the kinetic energy of the individual particles, but the total kinetic energy. I can choose a time coordinate so the total kinetic energy is most anything I like. So I would like to choose it so the total kinetic energy is equal to minus V. So I can choose F of S so, in other words, that's a gauge choice. It's like a choice of gauge in general relativity or a choice of gauge in electromagnetism. It's a gauge choice. And I can make that true at any time, and make it true at all times. So when I make that true, then what do I get? I just get M Q double dot is minus the derivative of V. And I get Newton's laws. So in this gauge, I recover Newton's laws from Lagrangian that look very different from the Lagrangians that we're used to using. But, there's one but. Okay, the one but is that I don't get every solution to Newton's laws. I only get solutions to Newton's laws where the total energy, as Newton would describe it, which is the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, is equal to zero. So I only get the solutions to Newton's laws where the total energy of the system is zero. So I might get one global constraint. I have one gauge invariance, one arbitrariness in the coordinatization, which is the freedom to parameterize the time. So time is meaningless. And I write the action as a function of the total kinetic and total potential energy, so it has something to do with Newton's laws. I write the simplest action that I can think of, which is reparameterization invariance. And then I get to use that reparameterization invariance to choose a gauge, choose a time parameter, cleverly, so that most of the complexity goes away, and I've left with Newton's laws, but I have one global constraint. I only get the solutions of Newton's laws with a fixed energy, namely zero. Okay. That's pretty neat, huh? This example is a lot more like general relativity than the last example. It's a lot, even if it's just simple and totally mechanical kind of system, it's a lot like general relativity, as we'll see. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand this last comment, because V is always defined after constant in classical mechanics.
Oh, sure. So if you wanted to take advantage of that, you could, if you wanted to make that explicit, you can come back here and you can pick the constant, say, V minus V.
Yeah.
If you did that, then you get the total, let me, so that's easy to confuse you. Let me call that epsilon. Okay, if I put a parameter there, I get the solutions with epsilon. Okay, but notice that epsilon is chosen as part of the dynamics. It's not like Newton. Newton, you get solutions for any energy.
Right, so it means that now what my point is that not this epsilon needs further interpretation.
Right, so it's the not point just is, number. This variational principle differs from Newton's in that you don't get solutions for every energy, you only get solutions for one energy. Using the fact possibly of putting an energy in here, you can get any energy you like.
Okay?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? I'm a bit puzzled as to why this case is so much closer to general to the previous one.
Because there's no x0, which is the real...
But can I push you on that? Because in the previous case, you can likewise choose an affine parameter, particular value of s, that makes the equation of motion very simple, q dot is equal to zero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's playing exactly the same role as the special parameter over here. That special parameter in the one particle case is not read off by an external plot, it's determined by the very motion of the system itself, just as in this case.
Fair enough, although if you had many particles, could you do that? You could do it just one particle at a time.
Well, you would find, I mean, if you put in many particles, that there's an affine parameter that makes the equations of motion of all the particles simple. So each particle is satisfied q dot is equal to zero.
Okay.
Of course, if you put in potential, I mean, interactions, you're just going to get something like this case.
That's fair enough. Fair enough. I don't want to fight too much about that, because we're going to come back and examine these things in more detail. But that's fair. Yeah?
So, from another perspective on this is that it's really a free particle, it always has been. It's just that instead of the metric being delta AB there, the metric is delta AB times B. So it's a free particle moving on a curved space, but conforming flat space.
That's one perspective on this, yes. That's one perspective on this. And it's interesting, what this says is that you can reinterpret in
then it's really very much like that.
Yeah, in some generality.
It's not relativistic.
Yeah, you can reinterpret in some generality Newton's laws for a system of particles as for one energy at a time, you can interpret that as motion in a curved configuration space. And that's right. And let me mention that this is not new, and this variational principle is not new. And indeed, this is sometimes called Jacobi's variational principle. And I don't really know the history, but that was sometime in the 19th century, I believe, that Jacobi studied it and understood that it was equivalent to Newton's variational principle, the Sterne variational principle, one energy at a time. And I don't know to what extent there was a conversation in Jacobi's time about the relevance. There obviously wasn't general relativity in the work of the notion of vision working in the 90s. When this was reinvented by Barber and Bertoni, it was in the context of a discussion that may have as an illustration of a discussion. And we're not now, we're just through the Lagrangian problem, we didn't do the Hamiltonian. But there was another, yes.
Suppose V is not one from above and below, then you can't avoid having V equal zero at some place. Otherwise, you could just add a constant. Then you can't do that with definition, because otherwise your time parameter would need to be discontinuous.
That's fair. Sure. It's not a universal example. That's fair. Okay. Other comments?
Yeah, sorry, another one. But this system also incorporates somehow the energy time determination principle, because in one case you can fix the time and you can have any energy and the other way around. You choose one time and you can hold the energy.
Yeah.
And in the case, you have only one
energy possible. Save that thought. Because when we discuss the quantum mechanics of this, that will become an issue. But there's no reason, since this is a classic, I could rip on that, but there's no reason for me to. I mean, we will get to it in due course, and that will become relevant, very relevant. Okay. Since the E is, everybody agrees the E is arbitrary, I'm looking for my eraser, I'm going to, just for my own simplicity, discuss and continue with the notation where that's totally equal zero. But if you want that, that can be there. That absolutely can be there. Okay. So let's now talk about the Hamiltonian description of this system. I might say, again, if there are people who are bored, to keep you busy, the quantization of this kind of system is still a research problem because of the issue that you mentioned. In my view, there's some disagreement about that, and we'll discuss that when we get to it in some detail. Excuse me. Your lecturer has a cold. Okay. So I'm going to follow the usual steps. The momentum PAI. Sorry. This delta S delta Q dot AI. And we just already did this calculation. This is square root of minus b over t q dot ai and m and the mysterious factor of 2. Which means that there is a 2 out of whack of the whole thing, but I'll let you find out if you desire. And let's now look at forming the Hamiltonian. And notice, by the way, there's no constraint here. I mean, every Q dot has a P and vice versa. So there's no issue here like there was before. There's no Lagrange multiplier enforcing anything. The Hamiltonian is P A I Q dot A I minus Lagrangian. And so let's multiply this by Q dot. That's again the total. We sum over the particles. That's again the total kinetic energy. So this is the square root of the kinetic times the potential energy, and the factor of 2 works. And so this is 0. The Hamiltonian appears to be 0. So what's going on? Why is the Hamiltonian? It's not just, this is worse than it happened in the other example, that the Hamiltonian, when we were done, ended up 0. This is at the first step. Is ending up 0. Okay. And the answer is that there's a constraint we've missed. We've missed a constraint. So there is a primary constraint. There's not an obvious primary constraint in the relationship between P and Q dot. But I lied a little bit. There is a constraint. And let's think about it. Let me take the sum of P squared, summing over all the labels, over 2m plus v. If I square this, I get square root of minus b over t squared, which is minus b over t. I get q dot squared, which is t, summed up over everything. The 2 should work out. So this is just minus v. Plus v equals 0. So there is a primary constraint, and this guy is also called the Hamiltonian constraint, which is what I forgot to call it the last time. So the Hamiltonian H prime, following Dirac steps, I should add this to the Hamiltonian with the Lagrange multiplier. Notice the Lagrange multiplier is new. It was not there in the action, as in the last case. The Hamiltonian prime is the original Hamiltonian, plus lambda times this primary constraint. And the original Hamiltonian is zero. That's what we just saw. So the Hamiltonian that we should use, this H prime, is the Lagrange multiplier times the constraint. So again, we have the form that the Hamiltonian is proportional to some constraints, which you remember was what we had in the last attempt. Okay, so did you understand what happened? This is just following Seurat's protocol for how to make a good variation principle. Now, there's no pi lambda anymore. And the constraint surface is just the Hamiltonian constraint so far. And notice, by the way, that that sort of reproduces in Hamiltonian language this claim that the total energy is zero. That is, p squared over 2m, which is the Hamiltonian version of the kinetic energy, summed up over everybody, plus the potential energy is zero. And it comes out as a primary constraint that is true by definition of the momentum. And since it's a constraint, it's zero on the constraint surface. So there is a notation that Dirac introduces in his universal. If there's a quantity which is not zero on the whole constraint, on the whole phase space, but zero on the constraint surface when the constraints are satisfied, we notate it like that, and we say that it's weakly zero. Weakly zero means a quantity which is a function of the phase space which vanishes when you go to the constraint surface. And this is such a case, this Hamiltonian H prime is weakly zero. Which was the case for the Hamiltonian in the first example. It was also weakly zero. That means it's proportional, the Hamiltonian is proportional to constraints. So I should write this. Okay, so let's go on with our analysis of the dynamics of the system. Q dot AI, which is the Poisson bracket of Q with the whole Hamiltonian, is lambda. This lambda is just an additive Lagrange multiplier, it doesn't have any non-vanishing Poisson brackets of it in, times the Poisson bracket of Q with the Hamiltonian constraint. And I'm going to put that over here like I did before. I'm going to call it delta of Q, which is the variation, the Poisson bracket of Q and the Hamiltonian constraint, and lo and behold, that's P over F. And there's a missing metric that connects those things. And so, this is equal to lambda P over F, and that's a familiar equation from Newtonian dynamics. M times P dot is P. But notice that there's this free Lagrange multiplier in it. And the fact that the Hamiltonian has this free Lagrange multiplier in it means that there will always be an arbitrariness in the definition of time derivatives. Why is there always an arbitrariness in the definition of time derivatives? Because this is realizing the reparameterization variance. Whenever this Hamiltonian formula spits out a time derivative, it has a lambda in front of it. And lambda is arbitrary, so it tells you that the rate at which time is flowing is arbitrary. But it's the same arbitrariness for all degrees of freedom. dot, we do the same thing. It's lambda times p with the constraint. And delta p is the Poisson bracket of p with the constraint. And that's minus v prime, that is dv dq ai. So this is minus lambda times del v del q. So again, that's the same as the formula for p dot in Newtonian mechanics. It says that p dot is the force, which is the minus gradient of potential. But there's this free function here.
Should be a p in the first Poisson bracket.
Oh, you're right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So we see that the Hamiltonian formalism, by virtue of following Dirac's steps, always reminds us that we're only doing dynamics up to an overall arbitrary definition of time. And we see this dual role of the constraint. We're restricted to stay on the constraint surface, so the constraint is always zero. And the constraint is also generating the changes under parameterizations. Now, let me say something that's confusing the first time you hear it. Some of you will be hearing this for the first time. Okay? And remains confusing, although there is a perspective in which it's not confusing. There are two different things going on, and they look very similar. One is how the, imagine that you have a solution to these equations, and that's your physical dynamics. So if I have a solution to these equations, so I'm erasing the previous example. So a solution is functions q as a function of s and p as functions of s. If we can integrate those equations, given a lambda, we can integrate those equations and find solutions. Because we can integrate these first order equations in time, q dot, p dot, given a choice of lambda. Lambda as a function of s itself, you can integrate those equations and find solutions. And the solutions depend on the choice of the functions lambda of s. Now, the claim is that lambda of s is just an arbitrary Lagrange multiplier. So if there is, and remember lambda, and if there is a transformation whereby I choose a different lambda, so this is the solutions choosing one lambda, and these are the solutions with same initial conditions choosing a different lambda. Our physical principle of invariance says they should be the same solution, the same physical solution. So a physical solution is the equivalence class of the pairs q of s and p of s, the function of lambda, for all lambda, and let me just say that we keep it strictly positive, make it simple. So there are an infinite number of different histories of the system that correspond to the same physical choice. the same sense, same physical evolution. Okay. Now, the same issues arise as arose before. What are the observables? What's the initial conditions like? What's physically meaningful? That is, if I have, you know, if I give you two, if I look on a computer and watch two evolutions of a system, how do I know that there is or there isn't a different choice of ground that it will map one to the other one? It's highly non-trivial. It easily gets highly non-trivial. And this is a much simpler case than general relativity. So there are two things, one of which is, what are the observables? The other one, another question, is what are the gauge transformations? That is, the unobservable changes. And another question is, what is evolution? Well, let me deal with the last two questions first, because there's a big confusion. And it is a genuine, it is something that is easy to discuss. If I make a change in lambda, if I go from one lambda to another lambda, and I make a small change in lambda, what's the change in the pair Q of S and P of S, and I'm dropping all the indices, but they're there, from a small change in lambda, which is also a function of S. What's the change? Well, the change is some delta of Q, which is a function of S, and some delta of P. And how do I compute those deltas to leading order? I compute those deltas by taking the Poisson brackets with the Hamiltonian constraint. Because the Hamiltonian constraint is the thing which is telling me how the fields change under time evolution. And infinitesimally, changing S in a fixed parameterization and changing to first order the parameterization are the same thing. Maybe I want to say that in big letters. Okay. So leading order, delta Q, which is Q of S plus DS minus Q of S, i.e. it's approximately delta S times Q dot, is the same, is proportional to delta Q, which is a variation of Q of S by delta lambda. That is the result of taking the D by D, the tame is badly, but D by D lambda means the change in the functions on the solutions when I change lambda. Now when I change lambda, I change S, and therefore this is the same as ds d lambda q dot, that is, this is something proportional to q dot. So to leading order, if I want to know how does my point in configuration space sitting on a constraint surface, how does it change when I fix the parameterization and evolve to the future, and how does it change when I change the parameterization, they're proportional. There's some function, which is the change in lambda. In other words, this is F prime. But for all A and I, delta Q AI is some fixed function times delta q ai. So the way that the system, that these degrees of freedom respond to evolution is proportional with the free function there times to the way that they respond to changing the time parameterization, because they're both proportional to the q dots, to the time derivatives. And therefore, h generates both delta q and p under time reparametrization and, quote, evolution, that is changed within a fixed time parameterization. So how do you separate out, is the question. How do you separate real physical evolution from the effect on the variables of changing the time parameterization? That's the question. And that's the same thing as the question, which I hope was right there, of what are the observables? In other words, the message is that the gauge transformations of the evolution are entangled, and we want to unentangle them. We want to talk about real evolution in time and real change in time. And to do that, we have to be careful about the observables. And I haven't told you how to be careful about the observables, but that's the lesson of this so far. Yes.
We have there that coming to talk about some work of the variation, like the back of the floor, which you just.
These up here.
No, the one behind it. Behind it, like, yes, shouldn't that be just first order in the variation?
Those are not spots on brackets, those are just lists.
Okay.
Those are just lists of Q's and P's. Sorry. So there is an issue, how do you separate out what's really evolving from what's not evolving? The answer, or one answer, I think we've used everything here. So we're going to discuss these in some detail later on. But let me just note that the answer, there is at least one approach, and it's similar to the approach that we had before. That is, for example, let's focus on some physical measurable quantity. So let's, for example, focus on the distance between particle 1 and 2. That's q1a minus, and this is as a function of s. This is as a function of s minus q2a as a function of s. And if I just write the norm, is that fine? We're in the Euclidean space, so the norm of the vector is the square root of dA, dB, delta AB, and it's a flat measure. Okay? So that's the distance between two particles. Now, if I have some crazy history of the system of the solar system, like this is like the distance between the Earth and Venus, let's just say. We take the distance between the Earth and Venus and describe the solar system. Now, as the system evolves, the distance between the Earth and Venus varies between some numbers. It changes. I'm not allowed to say what is the distance between Earth and Venus at some parameter time when the parameter s equals 17. Because the parameters are meaningless. Nothing depends on the parameters. But what I am allowed to do is the following. Let me consider the distance between particle 3 and 4, say the distance between Saturn and Jupiter.
That has the same definition. That's also a function of x. This by itself is meaningless because you would have to know what s means. This by itself is meaningless. What is meaningful is the distance between particles 3 and 4 at the time when the distance between particles 1 and 2 is a particular number of, say, 17 seconds. Or I guess 17, I don't know what, 17 billion trillion. Some number, what do I want to call it? R. Okay? This is physically meaningful. What's the distance between Saturn and Jupiter when the distance between the Earth and Venus is a certain number? And this is a function that I can call D34 as a function of the number R. Assuming that in the history of the system that we're studying, there is a time when the distance between the Earth and Venus is R, then this is a function of R. It's probably not for the whole real numbers of R, but for some range, some R within some range. Okay, so let me just finish the discussion. This, as a function of R, for every R for which it's defined, is an observable quantity. I just defined it in such a way that it's observable. That is, what you're doing is you're using the distance between the Earth and Venus as a clock, as a physical clock to measure the other distances in the solar system. And that's physically meaningful because I just told you how to do it without telling you anything about coordinate systems, clock times, or anything. So it's meaningful. Okay? And a thing that you can check is the delta of this is a function of R. Delta lambda is zero. That is, it doesn't depend on the choice of the time coordinate. Because, which you can compute that, and I invite you to compute that, but why it works is that physically, whatever time coordinate you're using, there will be a time when the distance between the Earth and Venus is R, and this measures the distance between this Saturn and Jupiter at that time. What this implies is that this quantity, D34 of R, has vanishing Poisson brackets with the Hamiltonian constraint. And again, that's something you can check explicitly. And you can check it for a large range of quantities, such as this. And objects like this are observable, and they go under a peculiar name. They're called evolving constants of motion. The constants of motion refers to the fact that they commute with the Hamiltonian. And remember, the Hamiltonian is proportional to H, the Hamiltonian constraint. So if they commute with H, the Hamiltonian constraint, they commute with the Hamiltonian. So these are all constants of motion. But they're evolving because I could put in different values for R and get a succession of values, and that will tell me, that will let me plot what is the distance between Jupiter and Saturn when the quantity R is 100 million, 110 million, 120 million, 130 million, etc. So these are observables. They're not the only observables, but these are observables. And so that's good to know that there are observables in the system. That's the good news. Now let me tell you the bad news. The bad news is I just lied. I gave you an argument that they're constants of the motion, that they are independent under changes of the time reparameterization. Therefore, they are independent under changes of Lagrange multiplier lambda. Therefore, they have to commute with the Hamiltonian constraint, which generates the changes in the time parameter lambda. Therefore, it should be possible to compute them and get zero. Compute those Poisson brackets. Okay, but I lied. And let me explain why I lied. Here's the phase space. Here's the constraint surface, which is a pretty complicated function, depending on what B is. It has the gravitational forces in it. It's a complicated surface. Okay, now, the different points in the phase space that correspond, that live in the constraint surface, correspond to different configurations of the system. But wait a minute, that's not quite true. Here I start with one, and here's the orbit under revolving by the Hamiltonian constraint. This tells me how this Q and P, which is on the constraint surface, should be changed if I change the time parameterization, holding some initial value fixed. So let me hold some initial value fixed and not mess with it. Then this value here on the trajectory is the result of either evolving in a fixed time parameter from that initial data, or just changing the initial value by changing the time parameter. So I can't, in a simple way, tell you what the initial data are. What I can do is say that each of these is a history, but I can't, without further specification, distinguish flowing along that history by changing the time parameter versus by evolving. So there is some ambiguity here. Nonetheless, supposing that I find some way to fix the initial conditions, and this is called fixing a gauge. Supposing I find some additional constraint that I'm going to require that breaks the invariance. So supposing I fix a gauge, and I'm assuming that you know what that means from electromagnetism. That is, I fix a gauge in the specification for the initial condition. Okay. So I impose some condition that breaks the symmetry. For example, I might say that the norm of the momentum of the first particle is always equal to 1 in some units. So no matter what's going on, the size of the momentum vector for the first particle is always 1. That's a way to fix the time parameterization variance. Okay. Then I can distinguish points here with initial data. Okay. Now somewhere in here, there's a surface where the distance between particle 1 and 2 is r. And here's another surface where the distance between particles 1 and 2 is r over 2, and so forth. Okay? Supposing that I fix some initial condition. Here, I fix the gauge and I fix some initial condition. And I've done it as simply as I possibly can. I'm not going to tell you how. Now I want you to compute that evolving constant of motion. I want you to compute d3, 4 on the surface here where v12 is equal to r. I want you to compute that as a function of the possible initial positions. That is, as a function of the possible, all the possible q's and p's such that we're on a constrained surface. Okay? That's a horrible calculation. What it says is, you give me the initial conditions for all the, first of all, I fix the gauge. So there's some quantity that is entirely defined by fixing the time differentializations. Okay? All the other momentum positions in the solar system are fair game for initial conditions. So I consider the space of such initial conditions, which is one dimension less than this independent dimensional surface. Okay. Now I want you to compute this quantity for every q and p that's leaving. Sorry, I forgot to mention it's restricted to this and restricted to the norm of p1 as well. What do I have to do? I have to pick a point on here, which is the initial condition, evolve until the distance between the Earth and Saturn is something. Look at how I did that evolution, and then go back and evolve the rest of the system to find out what's the distance between Jupiter and Saturn. And then I get a value for this function just to this point. So if I'm going to write this down, as an explicit function of the initial data, even fixing the gauge, I have to solve the equations of motion in closed form. To actually find out these functions, I have to solve the equations of motion. That is, I have to functionally, for every possible position of all the planets and other stuff in the solar system, be able to extrapolate forward from there to the point where the distance between the Earth and Venus is something, and then measure the distance between Saturn and Jupiter at that time. And that's to get a function. Okay. Now, there are two kinds of systems. There are systems that are integrable, that can be solved in closed form, and all the other systems. There's a bunch of literature where there are examples where this is done explicitly for things like two harmonic oscillators coupled to each other, four harmonic oscillators coupled to each other, things like that. And you can really do it and really carry it out. Okay. For any realistic system like the solar system, you can't carry it out in closed form. Now, I'm going to close by raising two questions. One of which is a technical issue, and the other of which may be worse. One of them is, if I want to make the connection to quantum mechanics, I don't just have to know what are the observables, I have to know what are the Poisson brackets. Because Poisson brackets go to commutators. So if I want to compute what's the Poisson bracket between T3, 4, 1, 1 and 2 is R, and say the distance, you know, between Mercury and Neptune, d115 at the same time. If I'm going to make a transition to quantum mechanics, I need these Poisson brackets. Which means I need to be able to do this not at points, but as functions, because I need to compute derivatives to compute the Poisson brackets. So that's really hard. How am I going to get the Poisson brackets? So that's one difficulty, and I'm going to write that down. Okay. How, you can put various weird words in your favorite language, will we compute the Poisson bracket? Okay, that's the first level. Somebody might claim if you can't solve that problem, you can't quantize the system. Second problem, generic systems, including the solar system, and claims our general relativity are chaotic. Chaotic means that every orbit comes arbitrarily close, arbitrarily many times, to every open set in phase space, which here means on the constrained surface. Consider a function which is constant on those trajectories, which is what such an embodiment constant of motion is. It's not going to have any derivatives at all, because if it's constant on trajectories that are chaotic, at least in the finite dimensional space, it's for sure not going to have any derivatives. Okay. So are the Poisson brackets even defined in the case of the solar system? That is an argument due to the great relativist Ted Newman that I heard him give twice, but he just claims he denies it. In any case, that's known as Newman's argument in the literature. He used to often make that argument, but I'm not the only person who heard it. Newman's argument, okay. And the basic way to express it is, does any of this work for chaotic systems? Bearing in mind that general relativity, we know that sectors of the finite dimensional sectors of general relativity, like the Bjarke-Mann model or so-called mixed master universe, are chaotic. There's arguments of, it'll come to me in a minute, that binary pulsar systems are chaotic because of spin and spin orbit interactions from the spins of the neutron stars, general within. There's detailed calculations in general relativity that suggest that they are, for some values of the parameters, chaotic. By the way, it's a big issue for LIGO, but that's not our problem right now. If general relativity is chaotic, then how are we going to compute with such observables, which require integration of the equations of motion to define? Okay. So let me stop there. There's a lot more to say still about the Barber-Bertoni model, but this sets up, I hope what we did today is we set up the basics of the Dirac-Hamiltonian formalism. We gave two of the three examples I was going to give, so the third example is electromagnetism, which we'll do next time. And we'll continue to discuss next time Hamiltonian dynamics. So, questions?
Yeah. So, then when you define the clock by V34 as a function of V12, with V12 having a certain value R,
yeah,
but that can be one to many.
I didn't even mention that issue, of course, because these are quasi-periodic, yes. Yes, that's another issue. Another issue. And that kind of thing can happen even when it couples a bunch of harmonic oscillators.
So basically, if you have a chaotic, I mean, in general, then cannot view a D34 as a function of R as a set and not a single value. But then if you have a chaotic system, then it's a countably infinite set, so it may, for all practical purposes, it may cover your whole phase space.
Right. So that's the kind of issue. That's the kind of issue that Tim Newman is doing. To me, there's a lot more to say about this if I'm introducing it, but when we get to the case of the real stuff, general relativity, if you like string theory things, there's a similar discussion of string theory that people want, we can carry it out. If the instructions for computing observable quantities in the classical theories involve tremendously difficult or impossible to carry out in closed form operations, what is their status? And there are two levels of issues. One issue is practical, that is, we want to make predictions from these theories. And practically, well, maybe you can find domains where things are nice enough and unchaotic enough, and you can define a perturbation theory
and construct observables. So, for example, in cosmology, people really do construct, go through the issues of gauge invariance and construct observables having to do with the CMB. But that's usually, to my understanding, a little bit of small fluctuations and small perturbations around something. And it's already a lot of work, a very complicated thing to do. But those, you know, are there, what happens if you go really nonlinear to those observables? But there are also, I think, issues of principle that that touch on the relationship of mathematics to physics and so forth. That is, if I have an implicit definition of a set of observables, but I can't compute their Poisson brackets, have I really studied the system sufficiently? Can I study the system sufficiently? And these are kind of, these are issues that will come up. So this is just our first introduction to this.
Okay.
Yes.
At one stage, you mentioned that there were two ambiguities in this sort of approach to dynamics. One was the choice of lambda, and the other was the choice of S.
They're really, I was being imprecise. They're really the same thing.
That's what's confusing me. I mean, you say that lambda is a function of S, but in the Lagrangian, how are they connected? I mean, why isn't this a free choice of the Lagrangian multiplier in the case of lambda? Why does it have anything to
do with it? So in this system, it's a good question, and maybe I'm not prepared to do it in a way that doesn't waste your time. In this system, the two systems are different in this respect, because in the first system, lambda was in the original Lagrangian and it had its transformation properties. And the fact that it was a density, so it changed as you changed S, linked the two. Okay. Here, lambda was introduced in the course of the Dirac thing, and we didn't study what its transformation properties were. And maybe the right thing to do is to reserve that rather than wasting your time. The answer is in studying what the transformation properties of lambda have to be. But I think I'm not prepared to do that in front of you. But that's the question you have to ask. Okay. Okay. So go home and think about the Barber-Bertoni model. And seriously, anything that you cannot do in the Barber-Bertoni model, you cannot do in general relativity. Okay, so if you think that general relativity is a physically meaningful theory, you better be able to make a physically meaningful theory out of this. Okay, so see you all next time.